Another thing on the what I asked you about was the parties and the good times that you had in the early days. Again, a lot of people think it was all very dreary and you just hung out.
One other little story must be told first because it leads up to the New Year's Eve party of 1941. And so, parenthetically, I'll tell you this. The New Year's Eve party of 1940 had 19 or 20 people present. It was out in a log cabin, a summer cottage, where we had a great big roaring fire. And I think there were 19 people there, and we had food enough to feed 90. I know that. Everybody making contributions, like Mr. Kirshner with the baked beans and so on and so forth. And the following year, we had one of the world's greatest New Year's Eve party. With 200 or more people present. In the meantime, some of the following happened. Pete Brinkman. Now, he's still alive. Name is Norman Brinkman, but Pete would not care about my violating his anonymity. Was the sickest man I ever saw in my life to live. And on the night that Katie and Eddie went over and inaugurated the Greater 24-Hour Program, CJ and I went to call on the Brinkmans. Pete was in a cataleptic state with his hands in absolute rigidity. And his wife was beside herself. She was a charming lady. CJ and Pete Brinkman had gone to the same parochial school together when they were small boys, had gone to the same parochial high school together when they were boys, and they were contemporaries of each other. And when Pete, in his drunkenness, said, "You're CJ, I can't believe it." And we left that night, and Charlie Kirshner called Dr. Pat McCarthy. Now, this is an interesting and significant name in Toledo. Dr. Pat was a non-alcoholic, of course, and well-known in town. He knew all these Irish guys like Kirshner, or German Irish like Kirshner and Brinkman. And CJ called Dr. McCarthy and said that the man was going to die unless you get him into the hospital, and not the insane asylum. Dr. McCarthy says, "I don't know what I can do, John." He said, "It's up to you." So Dr. McCarthy went to the superintendent of Women's and Children's Hospital and said to the superintendent, "Do you want a man's death on your conscience? I want you to put this man in your obstetric ward in a private room. I'll give you 24-hour nurses, but we're going to save him." So the very first hospitalization that we had in Toledo was Pete Brinkman in Women's and Children's Hospital on the obstetric ward. And Dr. McCarthy had him on 1 ounce of whiskey every 5 hours. And then the guys would come in and talk to him. And everybody talked to him. We didn't have very many people to 12-step. Yeah, right. So if you got a 12-step, you got the Rolls Royce treatment from Alpha to Omega, you see. And Pete would, about the 4 hour and 30 minute time, his stomach told him that the booze was about to come, and he'd start screaming for that booze. And after 2 or 3 days, and his nurse had to be in the room there with him all the time, because that was the condition that he got to stay in that hospital. She could hear all this conversation. But Pete started, this was on the 10th of January, 1941. When Pete started screaming for the 3 o'clock feeding of, in the afternoon of this whiskey, this girl said to him, "Mr. Brinkman, aren't you paying any attention to what these men are telling you? Let's see if you can't miss this one." And Pete all of a sudden said, "I'm going to miss it," and he hadn't had one since. Now, last Thanksgiving, he had open heart surgery, and he survived. That was Pete Brinkman, after all these years. Now, he went on, and he and I were the co-chairman of the New Year's Eve party the following year. And we had it in one of the public buildings in Toledo, in a shelter house. And we had a square dance, and we hired a caller. and we had the doggonest layout you ever saw in your life. And I, Noel Brinkman and I took 2 or 3 days of my vacation at that time. And he and I worked on that thing, and it was a great success. And the following spring, I moved to Buffalo. But all of 1941 was a very interesting time in Toledo. I wish that Katie would tell a little story about Gretchen. Can you?
We had a girl who...
She's just going to give her first name.
She had been drinking down in New York, been living down in New York. She came back to Toledo. And somebody in New York had talked to her about AA. And so when she came back, she had our name. And maybe she'd gotten our name from the office. I don't know. And she called. And she came out that evening. And she was a very nice person. And we had a pleasant evening. And she seemed pretty sold on the idea. And she stayed sober for about 5 months. And then she thought she could go to New York. And that was the best. She got down there, and her friends there were a pretty heavy drinking crowd. And so she came back again, and she just couldn't seem to get off the liquor again. And she got on pills, too, at the same time. And where she got filled, we don't know. So everybody was working with her, and the more we worked with her, the more difficult she became. And Duke had to go out of town, and the day he left, he left on a Sunday, he said, "Now, Katie, I don't want you getting mixed up with Gretchen. You need a rest. And just forget it." And he said, "If anybody calls, you're just busy." And I promised faithfully that I would do that. Following the morning, quarter seven, telephone. It was a couple of our members.
Chet Warren was one.
And Buffalo. And they said, "Hey, you got to come and help us." And I said, "What's your problem?" And they said, "We're at risk. You've been up with her all night." And I said, "I can't have her alone if she's drunk." And they said, "Joe, do you think she's calmed down?" And they said, "You've got to come. We're at a point where it's distressing." So I went down there to her apartment and walked in, and I did walk right out, because that girl was stripped. They were embarrassed. And she, I sat down, and she said, "Katie, I want you to go get me a drink." And I said, "I'm not going anywhere." And she said, "All you have to do is go to the kitchen." And I said, "Gretchen, you don't need a drink. Now we're going to get you sobered up and get you cleaned up." And she said, "You go get me a drink. I got a whole ice box of beer out there." And I went out and opened the door, and it was filled with beer. And came back and lied through my teeth and said, "Gretchen, there is no more beer. You've drunk it all." She got up and stumbled to the kitchen, and she couldn't get the ice box door open. I knew she was too drunk to do it. But she got a drawer open. She threw knives at me. She threw pots and pans. It's a good thing she was drunk, or I'd been dead.
Right.
A butcher knife.
Yeah.
And she banged up everything in the kitchen. And then she came out, and she was so mad at me. And she had oil rugs on the floor, polished floor. And she slipped on a rug and slid across the room and slid her head open just above the eye. And then, of course, she wanted help, but she still was drunk. And I said, "Well, we're going to get you to the hospital." And she She said, I won't go. I'm dirty. And I said, you're filthy. And she said, well, you got to help me take a bath. So I scared to death. Got the drunken girl, poor girl, in the bathtub. And I was kind of thin in those days and didn't have very much strength. But how am I going to manage this? And all the time I had to keep ice packs tied around here, you know, to keep this from gushing the blood. And the only reason she was going to the hospital, because I told her she'd be disfigured for life.
Yeah.
But she had to get in the hospital. And we finally got her in a clean gown and a robe and slippers. And she made me take all her fur coats she had for her. And she was on one arm, and I had the fur coats on the other.
Four fur coats?
She made me take them home with me.
Oh.
And all her jewelry.
She was quite wealthy.
Yeah.
So, she didn't want to leave it in the apartment. And so I got her to the hospital, to the emergency. And they took her in, and they told me that she had too drunk to give an anesthetic, and they'd have to spell this without an anesthetic.
Wow.
And it didn't mean anything to her, but she wouldn't let them throw her up or take her in unless I went with her.
Yeah.
And I had to go there, and she had beautiful fingernails, long, and she held my hand, and she cut those fingernails into my thumb while they did that. And I couldn't do a thing because I had to hold her still.
Yeah.
And I thought you were going to kill me when I got home. Because that really was quite an experience.
I met a woman in Florida, and I'm not sure, it sounds awfully familiar, but she was from Bowling Green, outside of Toledo, right? And was the first woman there, and I do believe she said Gretchen was the sponsor.
Well, that could possibly be.
Gretchen something.
But how long has Gretchen been dead, honey?
She lived 5 years after she sobered up.
Oh, this woman was sober in 1941 or something like that. Got sober.
What was her name?
I just can't think of her. Very delightful woman.
We had
would probably
women.
Know her.
Yeah, undoubtedly. We knew all about Bowling Green. We had some really interesting people down
she
there.
She worked in a restaurant or bar almost in the beginning.
Well, we had a man that owned a bar. He went on a 15-minute program. He couldn't think beyond 15 minutes. He had such a wet brain. So 24 hours was beyond his comprehension. So he worked on a 15-minute program. He stayed sober till he died, though, didn't he? As far as we know.
Yeah. She got sober around Christmas one year. Well, like it doesn't matter, but she told about commuting from that her first meeting was in Toledo. They didn't have a group in Bowling.
No.
So she went up there, and I do believe she mentioned Gretchen.
Could be.
Gretchen lived for 2 or 3 years after we moved away.
Well, anyway, so I'd like to, a little more. I know there were also Saturday night parties, at least in Akron. They had all those Saturday night gatherings.
Oh,
well,
homes.
Ours were extemporaneous get-togethers
right.
in homes, and we had a lot of that. That, to Katie and me, is AA.
Right.
You see Niles and Dave, I'm sorry. I'm getting absent-minded, I think. But here, Dave, I think you'll agree with me, so much emphasis is put on going to meetings because we have meetings in the hundreds here.
Right.
You can't drive 15 miles in Southern California without running into a place where there's an AA meeting.
Sure.
When Katie and I used to have to drive 120 miles to a meeting.
Right.
So we didn't have meetings to depend on. So we had daily contact. And that, to me, is a very satisfactory thing. I don't want to be inaccurate in my statement, but The statement has been made that the first dozen in Akron stayed sober. Is that about right, Miles?
Well, no, I don't think so. They quite a few had slips of some kind. Yeah. I think the only one who had a permanent slip was Ernie Galbraith.
That may have been the case.
I mean, they had stayed sober.
There were several whose stories were in the book who didn't survive. And who did. But now Dick and Paul Stanley both were sober.
Right.
And I'm sure that, and you said this man,
Bill Dodson was sober.
Dodson, and of course Bob.
Ernie Galbraith was poor. He had trouble consistently.
But they had a slip
Jim after Scott. A few months.
Jim Scott
stayed sober.
He wasn't in the first 10. The first 10 or 12, I think, got up to Bill Van Horn.
Oh, now Bill,
and he stayed sober. Bill, he had a slip, though.
Do you know the story about the first AA baby?
No.
Oh, now, let's make attention, Niles, on this tape.
Yeah.
I may not be absolutely accurate in the dates or the names, but it's an interesting story anyway, and of attention. I think it was Bill Van Horn that married an alcoholic woman, and she got pregnant, and it was the first AA baby, and Dr. Bob sweat out that pregnancy, wondering what kind of a monster was coming. And it turned out to be a delightful little baby girl who now, of course, would be knocking at the door of 36 or 37 years if she's still living. I think that's an interesting
story.
And while Dr. Bob wasn't an obstetrician, believe me, he was present when that baby was born, because that was the very first one.
We had an awful lot of fun about that, because you get up to Kessler's and everybody would be entertained, the baby that was on the way.
Yeah, everybody was very solicitous of the mother-to-be, believe me.
Yeah.
She had an awful lot of people that were interested in her.
That
would be quite a traumatic thing, This is a tremendous experiment.
This was, this daily contact is another thing. I mean, like I heard some of the guys in Akron, we had some old tapes of some of those earliest members, so that's where I got it from. Mentioned, that they would have breakfast with each other, and they would meet for lunch, they would ride around with each other all day, and that kind of thing. Talking about AA.
It was just a normal thing that everybody got in touch with somebody, and usually several somebodies, every day, just to talk on the telephone.
In Toledo, that was our case too.
Yeah.
And even when we got very big. I shall never forget when it became necessary. Well, I'll say we prospered when we got to Camp Hall.
Yeah.
And it really began to get big. And Dr. Walton Cole came to visit us. He was the Unitarian minister. And he was so impressed that he said, I'm going to preach on AA next Sunday. And he'd forgotten that was the first Sunday of Lent. Nevertheless, he didn't change his statement. He spoke about AA on the first Sunday of Lent. And he set aside part of his sanctuary, certain pews, for us. And there were 25 or 30 or thereabouts of us, and we came to the church, and we were isolated.
We didn't know we were going to be isolated.
The other parishioners kept about 3 feet away from us, wondering whether or not we had some kind of communicable disease. And Dr. Cole then was one of our staunchest supporters, and he spoke about AA quite frequently from his pulpit. Well, we began to grow, we just had to have more than one meeting.
Right.
And that was an emotional trauma when we had to create some new groups. One guy even got drunk over it. You're going to divide. And it wasn't a matter of dividing, it was a matter of expanding. But we had people get mad, and then the division of some of the money, and it became very great, and so on and so forth. But it was just another manifestation of the fact that alcoholics are just a little different than anybody else, and if you get some of them that are a little bit imbalanced psychiatrically, they can run into some big problems.
You had the idea, in other words, when you broke, split off in Toledo, you did it with a kind of a plan.
An expansion plan.
That was the idea. Geographic.
Our idea was to have meetings in different locations.
Right,
so,
right.
Because after all, the winters are pretty severe there.
So you set up the meeting. That was different because in most places they got mad and split off.
Well, it was a very interesting experience. And then is when we began to interest the people in the city fathers. And we got the idea of meeting in these shelter houses, which were part of the park system of Toledo. And they gave us those places free rent, and then gave us permission to bring in our coffee service and serve food and so on.
The place was little slockers
and so on, and it was quite successful. And we began to, to follow this hospital business. At the last information that I got, there are something like 2,000 beds in northern Ohio for alcoholics. Now that sounds like an astronomical number, but I think it could be accurate. It would be including the Cleveland area.
Right, right.
And that's quite a thing from the obstetric ward
right,
Women's
right.
Hospital. So.
Well, it's always been. I mean, we think there was no cooperation with doctors and professional people in the early days, but there were quite a few.
Oh, sure there were.
So,
some doctors were reluctant.
But
some went along, and very wisely so. And
Dr. Bob got very good cooperation from City Hospital.
Oh, marvelous.
Do you know Dr. Ruth Fox? Have you ever met her?
Yes, I've met her.
She grabbed, yeah.
You know, one of the things you mentioned about your own stay, which is the first time I ever heard it, is that you were sort of furloughed from the hospital. You went out from City Hospital one night and then went back.
I was there Friday, Saturday nights, and left Sunday. Friday night and Saturday night I stayed in the hospital. But you see, in those days I could get a hospital room just as cheap as I could get a room at the hotel. And so they suggested that hospital beds were easy to come by,
And there was no problem about him going out of the hospital.
I wasn't.
You weren't.
Oh, no.
And he wasn't under medication.
Right. You weren't on the treatment. No, this was...
And it was because it was a convenience.
Yeah.
And there were usually two or three to a half a dozen patients up there in the hospital, all with private rooms.
Right.
And costing no more than a room in the hotel. $8, something like that.
Well, I think...
About $8. $6, $7
a month. Yeah, they went up there. It's amazing. That's... The other thing is, before we get away from Cleveland, from Akron and Toledo, what about Annie? Do you have any recollections of Annie?
Annie Smith?
Oh, my, yes.
Was the Rock of Gibraltar, just like Bob was.
Yeah.
She probably did more to help the wives, or there weren't too many non-alcoholic men in those days. But there were a lot of wives.
Yeah.
And she gave us a feeling of stability. Of, being where we belong. And she always had the right thing to say for whatever the situation was. The meetings, meetings even today. People say things that you wish they hadn't said. And my main objection to speakers today is their free and easy language. I just think that isn't necessary. I think there are better ways to express yourself.
Right.
And I don't think you have to tell all about your sex life to make an AA speech. And if the slightest slip of any kind were made, Annie always said it right. You know, she said just the right thing. So that it, whatever had happened didn't seem that bad.
Right.
You know.
Do you remember any examples of that, or anything in particular?
It's hard to remember back that many years to think of the things she said, but you couldn't feel bad, have any feeling of animosity toward anybody for anything they said or did, because she just didn't allow that.
Right. She was
that wasn't
very
in her soul.
Person,
yeah. That wasn't in her soul. You know, she always had to. One of her favorite expressions was, you really shouldn't criticize that remark, because if you go back to that old proverb of walk a mile in my moccasins before you make a criticism.
Right.
And that was a favorite expression. She'd say, you don't know what that person has done or thought.
Right.
So until you have known what he went through, then you really can't be objective about it.
Right. Yeah, that's good. She was a marvelous, very tolerant. Anything that you remember Dr. Bob saying while we were on the two of them, or the, you know, any particular jokes? I know he loved jokes. He loved to tell stories and hear stories and things like that.
Well, I think one of his favorite things to say that I remember was you'd ask him about something and he'd say, well, why do you ask me? I'm not an oracle.
Yeah.
I'm not an oracle. You know, as if he could just come out with something that would solve the whole thing.
Yeah. And he was fond of quoting the good book.
The good book, yes.
Yeah,
of course, you know his famous description of himself when he came home. A potted husband with a potted plant. And he came home and he met Bill that night.
Right.
He laughed about that. And anyway.
Yeah. I didn't hear that quote. That's very good.
Well, that's the way he described himself.
Yeah.
You see, it was the day before Mother's Day, and he was pretty drunk, and he brought this plant in a pot, and he said, later, that's what I was. I was a potted husband with a potted plant.
Yeah.
And then, you know, of course, the story.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And did you ever meet Henrietta? Did you?
I've talked to her several times. I have her waiting to meet her.
Is she still living?
Yes.
Oh, that's marvelous.
She's
dark.
Way
up. She'd be along here.
Yeah.
She was a, you know who we refer to as
Henrietta? Now, she came to meetings regularly.
Yeah, she was at King's School.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
She was.
And would come down to the donut shop with us, and she was delightful. She was great fun. And we enjoyed knowing her.
Someone said she moved back to New York right after and didn't have much.
Not right after.
Yeah.
Not right after, because she was there all the time that we were going to Akron. Now, we happened to be in on the first meeting in Youngstown, and Dr. Bob led that meeting.
Uh-huh.
Do you know anything about that?
No, but I'd like to.
All right. Now, we got Youngstown started. I say we because every group was trying to assist, or every community was trying to assist every other community. Youngstown used to come over to Akron to meet us. Because they were just a stone's throw apart, you know, less than an hour's drive. And but Youngstown began to increase. So we got together in Neil Kennedy's front room, a good-sized home with a large living room, on a Sunday evening in Youngstown, and had the first meeting, and Dr. Bob led that meeting with his... leaning up against the back of the mantelpiece, I can visualize it, can't you? Just talking to us. And there were two or three brand new ones,
And then there were some others there that had a good many, well, Neil had upwards of a year of sobriety by that time, Neil Kennedy, and some of the others did. Dr. Althoff was an optometrist there in that town.
But he had been sober for a long time on his own. And then he heard about AA, and he thought, well, this will make it easier.
Right.
So he joined forces with AA.
That happened in New York, too, you probably know. Fred Ginsberg?
No, but it happened with Sutton in Boston. We knew that crowd very well. Dr. Jelinek wanted Sutton to take a drink. See, to see what had happened. Dr. Jelinek didn't care whether. But he was taking a scientific viewpoint.
You meant he didn't care.
And Sutton had been sober 15 years before AA came to Boston. Dr. Jelinek would say to him, Sutton, now why don't you have a highball? I want to see what's going to happen. You don't belong in AA. Sutton would say in his homely way, Dr. Jelinek, you go fly a kite, or would you? But that was happened to a few
years.
However, Youngstown there is a kind of a cute little story. After they got going, then they tried to find a place to meet, and Dave Sweeney was designated to, because he was a veteran of World War I, he was designated to go down and see the American Legion to see if they could get that hall to meet on Sunday night. And he identified himself as Alcoholics Anonymous, and the American Legion said, no, sir, no drinking. They weren't going to have anything to do with it. And Dave had a heck of a time explaining that it was the last thing.
Right.
But they did get the American Legion Hall.
Yeah.
In Youngstown.
The Youngstown story. Did you know Norman Young over there? Did you run into him, the blind man?
No.
Well, yes, I knew who he was, Norman the blind man, yes.
Yeah.
But I just knew who he was.
Yeah.
That's all.
He had started in Youngstown and moved, I think. Did you know Jack Darrow by any chance?
No, see, Jack was very active at Cleveland.
Right.
And I think he came in about the time we were leaving that area to move to Buffalo.
Right. He was from New York
to move out to Cleveland.
What are the two fellows' names that went to Buffalo about the same time we did, from New York?
Well, there was
Arnie
Cummings, who went from Cleveland, honey, and Arthur Burke. Do you know that name, Art Burke?
No.
You know the names Gene Hawes and a man named Hughes? Both of them were originally friends of Wilson, and they got sober in AA, and then they'd go around the country.
No.
And they both happened to be in Buffalo when Bill came through there one time with Bobby Berger and Gene Hawes, and I can't remember Hughes' name. Gene Hughes and Gene Hawes.
One of the other thing on was Dorothy Snyder. You mentioned her. Was that Clarence Snyder's?
Clarence Snyder's wife.
In other words, and married another fellow.
That's right. Now here is the story, and this again now is going to be on tape. And so Clarence is still living.
Yeah. Well, we got it all on tape. We got so much on those tapes that it all is inaccessible to anybody.
Well, then you know that. They had their divorce after he had a full year of sobriety, and then it was a very calm, quiet, friendly sort of thing.
Right.
And then Eddie Brewer and Dorothy fell in love with each other, and they were married.
Much later, though,
as Katie said. And then he died. And then she moved to California and married another man in AA. Who?
Murphy.
Dr. Murphy.
Dennis.
And then she has passed away.
Right.
And she
was marvelous.
She became a member of AA.
He did a marvelous amount of work and corresponded with the office. So
yes, indeed.
Okay, now after You moved to Buffalo. Wait, first thing, one more question. Your meetings in Toledo followed the Akron pattern, wasn't it?
That's right.
But they were the same, a leader and
a leader and then open forum discussion.
Right, right.
How did you close your meeting?
The Lord.
Always with the Lord.
That's what I wanted to close. I talked to Nell and she wasn't sure, but she thought that started in Akron.
Henrietta in the Oxford group, I think. Thanks.
Always with the Lord's Prayer. Any place we've ever been, including Rome, Italy.
Right. Oh, right. So they were the same pattern. And then after that, you moved to Buffalo.
Buffalo.
What were the meetings like in Buffalo?
And they were very...
And the date was...
Names. Now, we moved to Buffalo at Easter time of 1942.
Right.
I got there on Easter Sunday in a blizzard. And Katie followed within a week or so, and we got an apartment, and we got in touch with what AAs there were. A man by the name of Joe Sewell Kate from... Chicago, and we called him Sue.
Uh-huh.
Or some of them called him Katie.
Yeah.
But when my Katie came to town, there were two Katies, and so we got to call him Sue, you see. And then Arnold Cummings was
from Cleveland,
and Arthur Burke was from New York. And then there were a few people in Buffalo that were fairly sober, not sober by any means.
Yeah, right.
We had one wonderful character that went around with the book under his arm, visiting all the bars and trying to convert people to AA while he drank.
he stood there and drank highballs and quoted from the AA book. And we met the first time we met was in the basement of a boarding house, and Katie and I thought we were going down into the bowels of a dungeon.
We had to stoop down like this to get in.
And when we got there, there were 10 or 11 people all together, and this fellow who had been making the rounds of the bar led that meeting that night. And that was one meeting that was not closed with the Lord's Prayer. He said, "That's all." And he hadn't said very much. Well, we had a very interesting man there, a man by the name of Jim. Wasn't it Cooley? Wasn't it Jim Cooley? Anyway, he was there for the first time. And his wife was there. And she had brought him. And she was really a very forthright individual. She had practically grabbed him by his ear and had brought him to AA because she was going to get him sober. That's all there was to it. Well, they turned out to be marvelous friends of ours. His family owned the biggest dairy in Buffalo, and they really did a terrific job there. But the whole concept was so anonymous that there wasn't very much opportunity to expand. Well, as soon as Katie and I got there, we became articulate right away and got them up out of that dungeon. And I believe the very first place that we met was in our front room, wasn't it?
Brady's.
Oh, Brady's. Oh, that was an interesting story. The Undertaker's son. The Undertaker's son had been in and out of the National Guard, and then war was on, you see, now.
Yeah.
And it was after Pearl Harbor, and he was getting ready to go back in the National Guard if he could get sober.
Yeah.
He was more of an enthusiastic soldier than he was an undertaker.
Yeah.
But his father ran the big mortuary there in town, and so... Did we meet there over at the mortuary?
They got the chairs from the funeral.
They got the chairs from the funeral. That's what they did. And we met there for quite a little while. By the way, are we keeping you?
Yeah, we got all evening.
You free, Dave? From
oh,
you
yeah.
Got plenty of time. You don't have a family waiting for you with pork chops on the stove or anything.
She's studying for a test tomorrow. She's glad to have us out of the house.
I see. Well, what are you saying, Neil?
I'm at the ambassador.
At the ambassador. That's what you're saying. Well, Buffalo began to burgeon almost immediately. And we had another one of those barometers that we could go by. New Year's Eve of 1942, we had 150 people at the New Year's Eve party. And that was another interesting experience, because it was another way of getting AA known to the people. We created a nightclub. This is almost a year after Katie and I got there.
Right? Yeah, we got there in...
we got there Easter time. Right. And this was New Year's Eve. Right. We had a real estate man that had a downtown storeroom. And so we put some curtains up on the front there, and we created a nightclub, and we got an orchestra.
Right downtown.
Well, I mean, it was our main
street.
Out from downtown a little ways. Yeah. And Buffalo at New Year's time is cold, if you know.
Yeah.
But we had ourselves a nice big party. We had an orchestra, some colored boys that were good musicians, and we had
were AA members?
No, we hired them. We hired them, and but they were perfectly. We told them that we wouldn't permit any drinking by the musicians,
right.
And they were professional musicians,
right.
So they knew. Right. You know, musicians usually are the ones that are sober on New Year's Eve, because
they
got to play. So we had ourselves a ball, and we started raising so much cane that the police came to the back, and we invited them in, said, "Come on in and have a drink." And we took them up and we gave them Pepsi Cola. And the cops said, "Well, where's the booze?" We didn't have any. And then two of us got these two policemen and explained what it was. And they breathed a big sigh of relief, and they said, "Go ahead and make all the noise you want to. You will be visited by as many patrol cars as we could send over here during the course of the night."
We had a spread that we just wouldn't believe.
Every time they'd see a patrol car, they'd pull up and say, "We just got an emergency call out there at that place, and we're busy here. Would you go quiet them down?" Then they'd come to our place, and we fed Pepsi Cola to half a dozen police cars. That's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
We had a very successful time in Buffalo that year, and we got some very substantial people. A bank president, one of the leading attorneys of town. Was Tom McCann an attorney, or he was a business?
Stock.
That's right, he was a stockbroker. We had some very interesting times all the way through.
Did you ever run into a guy named Dave Welch? It might have been before his time.
That was before his time.
Yeah,
I don't
right.
remember that name.
He came to New York, but he always used to come to
Buffalo.
And that was really
I think an interesting thing. Duke had a commission from college in the reserve, and they had written to him at the start of the war asking him, because it had left, to come back in, and they would up his grade, and the company had said that because he was in the food business and because of his age and so on, that they really didn't feel that they could spare him, and they didn't think he'd ever be taken and so on. So he turned him down. And then we found out he was going to get drafted. And $21 a month wasn't very attractive.
No.
So he applied for a reinstatement of his commission later, and knew he would never get it up in his grade from second lieutenant, but anything was better than $21 a month. And we had to get two local references. So one of them was
the Undertaker.
The Undertaker there.
The father of the guy who got sober.
Right.
Just as a character reference.
Right.
And the other was your broker there.
My broker. Yeah. The broker down.
And the first person he called was the Undertaker. Yeah.
That is, the representative of the Provost Marshal called on the Undertaker.
You know, checking to get the personal references and so on. And this poor man, in his enthusiasm for AA, told this man from Washington how Duke had saved the life of his son. And he went on all about Alcoholics Anonymous and just, you know, and in those days, he didn't talk about it.
Right.
For anything like that.
Right.
And this was understandable because it was well enough known. So the first thing we knew, Duke's broker called and said, Duke, he said, a man called from Washington called checking personal references on you, and the first thing he asked me, what's this drinking club you belong to?
Yeah.
And Duke said, I don't belong to any drinking club. And he said, well, he said he'd been told that you belong to some drinking organization. Well, Duke couldn't tell this man about AA. You just didn't do it in business. You
this
know.
Guy was a colleague of mine. He was brokered our stuff, you see.
And so he said, well, I told the man, he said, I never saw Duke take a drink in the months that I've known him, and I've never seen his wife even take a drink. And he said, as far as that's concerned, they were over here the other night and we were playing cards, and everybody else was having a drink, but neither one of them touched a thing. And so Duke went all to pieces.
You can imagine.
Yeah, right.
Here I am, being crucified by being because I
right.
The way I felt.
Yeah, right, sure.
Well, you can tell me.
You go ahead. You're doing all right.
Well, he felt so bad and he couldn't sleep, and he thought, well, here he was, not going to get his commission reinstated, and he was just sunk.
Yeah, right.
And I couldn't seem to get him out of it. I said, well, you have no idea that this is so at all. And I said, certainly anybody telling, they'd certainly find out what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. They wouldn't just take somebody's word or take their idea of what it was. They couldn't, you know, just say, well, this guy's all wrong because he belongs to AA. And Duke said, oh, I'll never get it. He said, yeah, I'll have to go in as an infantryman, you know, just. And this went on this night, and I finally turned to him and I said, I was sleeping. And I wasn't even too sure of myself, you know, how it would turn out. But I said, you don't believe anything you've learned in AA, do you?
She really took a 12 step on me,
right? Yeah.
And I don't know whether you felt any better or not.
I sure did. I'm grateful, believe me. She.
Anyway, he got it.
Yeah. She told me that I might just as well believe some of the things that I'd been saying.
Right.
Which I thought was a very significant lesson, because each one of us are pretty glib in saying the things, but when it comes home, then we wonder. Then Katie called me, and I did feel better. And then I discussed it with some of my other friends in AA, and I remember this Tom McCann said, using a few good American Legion terms, well, I think the Army would be awful blankety-blank glad to have a sober officer, and so forth. And I began to feel better. Well, the orders came in, and I went on duty.
Yeah, no problem.
But you see, that was quite an object lesson. Yeah.
But it was delayed, and he got his commission reinstated just 4 days before he was to report for duty.
Right.
As a buck player.
And when that notice came, he just wrote on it, he had other orders signed his name by second lieutenant and gave his serial number and the whole deal so they could check on him.
Yeah, so then you went into the, you know, in the meantime, you were, when did you meet Bill?
Bill came to
Akron
quite early.
Right.
So and then he came over to our in Toledo. Right. Now we had met him before. He came to stay with us, but he came to stay with us after that big dinner, didn't he? I remember that we in Toledo had money enough to pay his railroad expenses from Cleveland to Toledo and back again, but not money enough to put him up in a hotel.
Right.
So he stayed in our home.
Right.
And we sat up all night.
Yeah.
Just like sitting at the feet of Socrates. You know? That was quite
interesting. And I think...
And Bill enjoyed it, too.
Yeah.
And there were maybe a...
better part of a dozen.
A dozen people that sat up all night that night, sitting on the floor because there weren't enough seats in the living room. You know,
do you remember anything about that? What he talked about?
Oh, yes, I should say so.
He
regaled us with story after story how the association had moved to Little Rock, Arkansas, and down there they made up some bylaws.
Right.
And you had to be recommended by a committee and passed on, like you were going into the Masonic Lodge or the Knights of Columbus. Then if you got a black ball, you couldn't get in AA.
Right.
And Bill had to straighten that up.
Right.
Then the experiment in Kansas City, Kansas, which I had heard about before because of my contact with Kansas City. Over there, they had what they call the Social Drinkers Club of Alcoholics Anonymous, which lasted about two meetings. Then everybody got drunk.
Right.
And Bill told us about that. Oh, he regaled us the story. He referred to the anonymi.
Yeah, that was a favorite. Life among the anonymi.
Life among the anonymi.
And you know, I think that would be a marvelous title for a book.
Reduce that.
And
that's a good idea. Right?
Yeah, and then Bill talked about how people wanted him, they called him the Grand Lama, and he didn't want that. And he said, thank goodness for Dr. Bob, or called it Smitty, thank goodness for Smitty. Every once in a while I get to feeling pretty good about myself, and then Smitty carves me down the side, which is true.
Yeah.
And did you ever hear the name Lefty Henderson?
No.
Well, Ralph M. Henderson got sober on the 10th of December, 1940, in Chicago. He was a protege of Clem, the famous man in Chicago, Clem somebody, the newspaper man, and Sylvia Klein, whose name you heard.
Right, right.
And then Lefty came to Toledo and spoke to us. He was a magnificent speaker. And then Katie and I saw him in New Orleans several times. He was managing a big firm down in New Orleans during the war when I was down there on duty.
Uh-huh.
And we got the New Orleans group going pretty well. Lefty got it pretty well organized, and it began to develop quite a little bit. And then when the war was over, Lefty had been a friend of Marty Mann in Chicago. So when Marty got the what she called the National Committee for Education on Alcoholism going, she arranged for Lefty to come to Yale, to Connecticut, to New Haven, where the Yale Corporation was financing this business, and he worked with the Committee on Alcoholism. And Lefty's picture is, did you notice that group picture in the scrapbook? Before it's over, we'll look at it again.
Right.
Bill Wilson is in there, Lefty Henderson, and yes, Gardner,
recognized.
And so he was a power, and we lost Lefty about 20 years ago. Now, his widow still writes to us. She then stayed on in New Haven and became the librarian and worked with Dr. Bacon for a long time, then moved on to Rutgers, then retired, and is living up in Oregon, northwest of Oregon. But I wondered where that man really was. Well, Buffalo was quite an interesting experience. And in Buffalo, we went to Syracuse, and I met Dr. Collier. Have you ever met Dr. Collier?
No.
Have you ever met Tebow?
Yes, I did meet him.
Dr. Peabody. Well, Dr. Collier was in Rochester.
Right, right. He was Dr. Jack mentioned Dr. Collier.
Yes.
Tell us a little about Dr. Collier.
Well, now, Dr. Collier was a quiet, very dignified, gentlemanly sort of a man, and very courteous. I called on him in his office, introduced myself as a member of AA in Buffalo, and he welcomed me, and even though he was a busy psychiatrist, we had 30 minutes of conversation. And then he was present, as Katie was, and so was I, at the first meeting of the Rochester group.
Uh-huh.
And Rochester developed pretty rapidly.
That Do you remember when that was?
Sometime in the summer of 1942. And Dr. Collier had also a couple of other MDs that he was interested in.
Very interesting, because one of these might have been Dr. Jack Norris, who was at Kodak and later became chairman of AA.
Could very easily have been, and you know, it never occurred to me, but I've got to know these men, and it could have been Dr. Jack, whom I have not met, but whose name I have met. Now you see, we left New York 19 years ago, and I don't think Dr. Norris was there. When did he go to New York?
1950, something like that.
Well, but
just about the time of the first conference.
Well, then I didn't get to meet him, because when we lived in New York, our AA activities were exceptions by going into the office every once in a while. We pretty much lived in Long Island, or we'd go over and speak at New Jersey or in Manhattan. Of course,
right.
Dr. Schumacher, Sam Schumacher, was one of my, I loved him. You've met him.
No, you? I never. He was before.
He was before. Yeah, you know, I think he's passed away.
Yes.
That's what I thought. But he was a great friend then. I used to like to go down into New York and listen to Dr. Schumacher, because he had his parish and his church there at Gramercy Park.
Yeah, Calvary.
Gramercy Park group met in his parish house.
Yeah, that's still a group there.
EGIF.
Thank God it's Friday.
Yeah.
And S, they added for Sunday.
And what group did you go to?
Manhattan group.
Well, where is that?
It's on 19th Street now. Uh-huh. But that was the old group that first met at Calvary.
Calvary, yes.
A little block from there.
I was called to active duty in, I think the orders came in right after the 1st of January 1943, because it was right after that New Year's Eve party of 1942. As I mentioned to you, I stayed in the United States all the time during the war, but that was an interesting experience,
right,
as a matter of fact, during the war, because while the first place that we were sent to after I did some training, because I'd been educated in military education in World War I tactics. And I went to school at Fort Totten, New York.
Uh-huh.
Katie went to Florida. Then we came back and we were transferred to Buffalo, or to Boston.
Right.
And we were there until 1944, and of course we had a lot to do with Boston AA.
Right, right. What was Boston AA?
Marvelous.
Yeah.
And it was, there was a little...
Let me say this. You know, you always think that Newlanders being cold.
Right.
I would have died in that town if it hadn't been for AA, because I never got to see Houston but once a week, and he could come home every other Saturday night, come to the apartment every other Saturday night, and then otherwise I'd have to go see him on Saturday night, but nothing in between. So it made it a lonely life. But AA just took me in hand, and I was just their child. All these wonderful men, they picked me up and take me over to their clubhouse, and we'd play bridge.
That's the AA game, bridge.
And every now and then there'd come a call, and if there was a woman involved, I had to go too.
I want Katie to tell the story of Christmas Eve of 1943. That would be it, Christmas Eve of 1943.
when the girl, we were over at the office, over at the clubhouse, and Bert Collier came in, and he had his protege. This is quite a story. Can you remember?
Well,
in the first place, she'd been sober for a matter of
6 weeks
or so, and then she went to a Christmas party. And she was getting on a train that night at midnight to go down to Maine to spend Christmas Day and the long weekend with her family. She was a widow, and she had a young child that was living with her mother. And then take it from there.
We had to get her sober enough to get on the train. And so Bert and Duke and I went over to this girl's apartment, and Bert said, give her a bath. She's filthy. She fell in the mud in the street. So here I was giving her a bath again. I thought, well, I'll sober up. Saved up. So I got her fresh. Just rushed her. And after I got her good and clean, I stood her under a cold shower. And all the time I was pushing hot coffee at her, which Bert had made. And it was so strong. We did get her sober. We got her dressed and we got her bag packed.
Done about scrubbing her?
Yeah.
Her package, and oh, she was so pink and red when I got through there on my barrel. And we got her down to the railroad station and got her on the train. And then we began to worry about maybe she'd get off someplace and get a couple drinks. So Bert and I got back on the train and talked to the conductor and said, you have the porter or yourself. Keep an eye on this girl and don't let her get off for any reason. Because she's got to get home wherever her, and her family was going to meet her.
Right.
And they did. They watched over her. She came home and was sober. And so far as we know, she was all
successful
right.
There.
Right.
Every time she looked at me, she'd say, I hate you.
What was the meeting format in Boston when you went there?
Same thing.
Same sort of thing. Right. Leader followed by open forum discussions.
Right.
They had a Sunday afternoon meeting. And quite a number of servicemen.
Yeah.
Quite a number of servicemen. And then they had a meeting on one of the other nights. And I can't remember what night it was. And then there was activity in the clubhouse every day.
Right.
And the servicemen would come in. Connie Kiley was in the Navy.
Heard of
the
yeah,
have you heard of Connie?
Yeah, where was she from?
Boston. Boston. Oh, an Irishman from Boston. Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. Connie's dead.
Yeah.
And
dynamic
speaker. Oh, terrific right. Speaker.
Oh, yes, he was a great speaker.
Oh,
right.
I should right. Say so.
I
He and Lefty Henderson are probably.
I didn't hear him, but I heard about people in New York mentioned that he came down.
Yeah, Gardner was in Boston in the Navy,
right.
But not at the same time that I was in Boston in the Army.
Yeah.
But he came up there after we were right. Transferred right. Down, and he was a powerful member true. Also.
We went down to Philadelphia one time, many years ago.
Long about 1947.
47, to some kind of a big meeting, an area meeting.
Yeah.
Something like that. And it lasted for a couple of 3 days. And I think we were supposed to be the inspirational speaker. And the Connie is the one who got up and told the story. And I'm going to say, he has people rolling in the eye.
Yeah.
He just held your attention to the point that.
Did you ever meet John Parkley?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Now John Parkley was one of the. And then Jack Mason, do you know that?
No, I don't know.
Well, now those were big names in Philadelphia.
Right, right.
And this meeting was at. We stayed at the Bellevue Stratford, and Yev and Betty Gardner and Katie and I had a suite, and then Connie and his wife were on the same floor with us, I know. And we had gone down for this 2-day meeting and so on. It was a great inspiration, I'll tell you that. And it was a good good fun, and good AA.
Right.
Good AA. Boston AA, it was the beginning of this idea of the National Committee for Education on Alcoholism. Marty Mann had not broken her anonymity at that time.
Right.
And neither had anybody else. But there was beginning to get this idea of trying to get the study of alcoholism and the subject of alcoholism being a disease into the business community. And there was a very lovely lady whose name was Whitney, and she was part of that Whitney family who lived in Boston. And later she became one of the powers in New England working with Marty on that. She was a member of the group. I don't think that's wrong.
This is all.
Say, cut that off for just a minute. I'm going to make a suggestion. I'll make a...
you're talking.
Well, I quit drinking a year before Duke did. Yeah. And then when he got in the AA, I really felt, and everybody felt, around Akron, that, you shouldn't ever take a drink in front of under any circumstances. So it was about 8 years that I didn't take a drink. I went to a party, and I had a glass of wine served. And I drank it, and I was so conscious stricken, I felt like I couldn't wait to get home and tell Duke.
That's marvelous.
Isn't that?
You know, that's another thing, too, that people always said, especially the earliest members, felt really that they were part of AA. I mean, there was no Al-Anon.
And when I got home and I told Duke this, he said, well, you know, today I am a man. Now, I didn't have any idea what this would do to him.
Yeah.
But he always had the feeling that I would never have a drink because of the fact that he was in AA.
Right.
And I was afraid.
Right.
And he said, now you make me feel that you have confidence.
Right. That's a very nice story because I think that, you know, sort of epitomizes a lot of AA's feeling that we are comfortable when other people are drinking and having, you know, prohibitionists.
You make me feel that you trust me now.
Right.
And he just thought that was great.
Yeah. But that's a great story.